On this episode of Video Culture, we'll talk One Crazy Night films, Into the Night, and Quick Change.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome again to another great episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And man, oh man, today we have two really great, pretty fantastical one-night movies where basically the entire caper of the movie takes place within a 24-hour period.
Yeah. Within one crazy night, if you will.
And this is, I mean, this is not a new concept.
No, right? There are many movies that follow this pattern.
No. So, but the two that we chose specifically were, like I said in the intro, this movie called One Crazy Night. There probably is a movie called One Crazy Night,
and there's one called One Crazy Summer, of course, which we'll get to at some point.
Yeah, which stars
Don Cusack.
Thank you. I'm so terrible with names. Am I so terrible with names?
One day we'll get there.
Love John Cusack.
That's going to be the end game of this podcast, to get you good at actors' names.
All right, so. But it's called Into the Night. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now that's the first movie that we'll talk about. Then we'll also talk about, Quick Change with Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. But the first movie we talk about is a movie you've probably not heard of. And this was filmed in, 1985?
I think it was actually 82, but let's pull that up. Let's actually do a little bit quick look and see, because I had it written down here. Let's see here.
It was 1985.
Oh, I apologize.
That's okay. I mean, it seems it would be earlier, but it's really not.
But it's directed by John Landis. It stars Michelle Pfeiffer and Jeff Goldblum. So we have a Video Culture alumni actor. We're talking about another episode about Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. Exactly.
He was one of my favorite actors. He was one of your favorite actors.
Right. And so in Dan Aykroyd, who we talked about in Dragnet.
Yeah, that's true. Dan Aykroyd, yeah, he has a small part in the beginning of it.
So Into the Night, how we both found this film, mm-hmm. I have to give credit to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema.
Mm-hmm. The podcast and the Facebook group.
Yes, the podcast and Facebook group. Now, we're both members of the Facebook group, and somebody posted about this movie. And I'm going to give you a brief synopsis of what they said, their kind of hook that describes this movie that really grabbed our attention. And both of us said, we have to watch this movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. Jeff Goldblum plays a depressed insomniac who impulsively decides to take upon a red-eye flight to Vegas after discovering his wife is cheating on him. Upon arriving at the LAX parking lot, he crosses paths with the beautiful and mysterious woman played by Michelle Pfeiffer, being chased by four gun-toting Iranians. He helps her escape and finds him embroiled in a wild chase through the streets of L.A. in this One Crazy Night narrative filled with a cast of quirky characters. This is a fun and sometimes thrilling dark comedy from director John Landis, who also plays one of the Iranian goons, featuring a cavalcade of cameos from the likes of Dan Aykroyd, David Cronenberg, Jim Henson, and David Bowie as a knife-wielding maniac, among many others. It also features some great R&B music, including B.B. King, who contributed to three songs to the soundtrack. Now, Pat Kelly is who wrote that from The Gentleman's Guide for Midnight Cinema back in early March of 2019.
So a big shout out to Pat Kelly.
Thank you, Pat, for bringing this movie to our attention.
Because weirdly, it's not one. It's one I had never heard of. I just kind of glossed over that in John Landis's filmography. I never really paid attention to it. And when I read that, I'm like, how have I not seen this? And you were like, how have I not seen this? So we rectified that.
The one Laserdisc purchase later for myself.
Yeah, and one digital rental for me.
Yeah, and because we don't watch these movies together.
No, unfortunately we don't. We will at some point, I'm sure. Right. Maybe we'll do actually a running commentary at some point. But we watch them separately, and then we come together to kind of talk about it.
So what to say about this movie, though?
It's... Well, first of all, my hope, and I'm going to be honest with my hope, that when I heard, when I saw this, when I saw who was in it, I saw who made it, I hope that it was a lost classic.
And the cameos and the, everybody.
Well, when you say David Bowie is a hitman, and it's got Jeff Goldblum as an insomniac, and Michelle Pfeiffer, and you find out Carl Perkins is in it, and you find out Dan Aykroyd's in it, you're like, I want to see this. I thought this maybe would be this lost classic film that I just never saw growing up. So I was so excited to see it.
Yeah.
And truthfully, I think I built it up for myself a little too much.
Yeah, I think so. Now, I will say it didn't quite live up to the hype for me either.
Yeah.
Especially the from that like glowing sort of like narrative of it. And although I will say it is accurate as far as
it's an accurate synopsis, but the movie your brain paints with that write up is not quite what you get.
No.
It's a little more episodic. It's a little more clunky.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just kind of get into it.
Right.
Jeff Goldblum, we all love Jeff Goldblum. He's playing a much more subdued character in this film. He's playing a guy suffering from insomnia.
Ed Oaken, who is an astrophysicist.
He's an astro engineer. And I got to say, every time you said Ed Oaken, I immediately, this is so dumb, but I immediately thought of Street Fighter II.
Okay.
Ryu screaming the Hadouken noise whenever he throws a fireball every time. Maybe I'm just a big loser. But
we'll just call him Ed then.
That's what I immediately thought of every time.
All right.
But anyway, so he's suffering from insomnia. So one thing we love about Goldblum, much like we love about Walken, is the quirky way he inhabits a role.
You
watch Jeff Goldblum to see Jeff Goldblum be Jeff Goldblum a lot of times.
Right, yeah. I mean, he's a lot like David Duchovny like you mentioned, Christopher Walken.
Nicolas Cage.
They kind of have their own cadence. They kind of have their own sort of like beat to their own drummer kind of thing. And it's like you watch them for that style. And I don't really feel like Jeff Goldblum had that style. And I think partially the part of the premise of the movie is that he's not getting a sleep. He's not sleeping. He's not comfortable in his
he's
marriage.
He's zoned out.
He's not comfortable in his marriage. He's not comfortable in his job. He's just kind of, and even, later in the scenes when he goes to work, he's kind of like zoned out and like not with it,
And I'll say that's the best part of the film. Let's digress for a moment and talk about the beginning. At the end of the film, you see him kind of laying in bed, wide awake, and then he gets up, eats his morning food, then gets in his car, sits in traffic, goes to his office job, and you see him kind of drifting in and out. And it really, this part of the film does a really great job of showing what it's like to not be able to sleep and the way you just kind of fade in and out of your day.
Right,
that kind of miserable slowness you feel.
Yeah,
and so that part of the film I thought was so well done.
Right,
and but the rest of the film does not have quite that amount of nuance to it. It gets a little clunkier and a little more zany as it goes along.
Well, and it took a long time to actually get to the part where you meet Michelle Pfeiffer, where you get to that part.
Yeah,
because he kind of gets called out at work for, making a mistake.
Dozing off and
making a mistake. And then so he kind of says, at lunchtime, he kind of tells his buddy, like Dan Aykroyd, tells Herb, hey, I'm going home. here's his, you know, wife, like, basically
cheating on him.
Cheating on him.
Which is what happens whenever anyone goes home for lunch.
In the middle of the day.
In the middle of the day. That's again, something that has scarred me for life as I go watch his films. I won't ever go home in the middle of the day when I'm in a relationship because I worry that is what I'll see.
And see a car, like, in the, parked in front of the house. You know, you're just like, oh.
So, while I thought this part of the film was good and well constructed, it is very lackadaisical.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes a while for the movie to get going and to fall into the adventure plot.
Yeah.
And the adventure plot's not really that important. It involves him running into Michelle Pfeiffer at the airport.
Right.
When he's gonna run away, and he's running into this mysterious girl who's smuggling diamonds from Iranians because emeralds from some foreign guys. It's the late 80s, it's the late 80s where Iranians were like the Russians, where they were just the big bad guys.
Well, that's the thing about this movie, is that it is not high concept. Concept being a movie that you can describe in like one sentence.
Yeah.
Okay, the MacGuffin that we talk about on these podcasts is very complicated.
Yeah.
You know?
It's really too complicated to be interesting.
It really is. I mean, you don't even know what's going on because she smuggled them. Her friend gets, like, killed by the Iranians.
Yeah.
She's trying to escape. She doesn't want the cops involved because she knows that what she's doing is illegal.
Yeah.
She's not telling him what's really going on. Yeah. She keeps it all very secretive.
And that's supposed to make you feel as kind of lost as the main character, which kind of makes you not have interest in what happens, you know?
Right. But what my point is earlier about the insomnia is that because Goldblum is kind of aloof and being a, you know, half awake character,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't really get a lot of Goldblum.
He doesn't go full Goldblum. Yeah.
Right. It's like he really himself. I mean, he was so good playing a person who is so tired but can't go to sleep. Yeah. That it's like, it's almost like he's not really like doing anything. It's
he has moments where he's funny. He has moments like when he's bumbling around, but it's always just like brief little shiny things or like,
right.
Oh yeah, that's a Goldblum-esque thing. And it's not, you're right, it's not a bad performance. It's just not what I expected.
Mm.
And I think it would have been a little more fun if he had been a little more of his kind of overwhelmed, kind of, you know, sputtering self.
Yeah. The movie kind of ends with the cops kind of being involved. There was a scene that I thought, like, Michelle Pfeiffer, or her, we talk about Diana, gives the emeralds, like, to her friend and hides them because she don't want to be caught with them.
Yeah.
But then the Iranians basically, like, finally figure it out. They go to the house where she's at. And she doesn't know that she has them, but they're like, these Iranians are just like going through their house. She just like gets so freaked out. She just starts running towards the beach.
And the Iranians kill her.
Drowns her.
And it's shot in a very kind of horror movie sort of way. And we've talked about it in this podcast. You know,
Sort of like, it was almost like it went from being this weird comedy to like The Godfather.
Like it's suddenly savage. Yeah.
Yeah. Like very, very dark and very vicious.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before. One thing that bugs me about movies is when they don't handle tone changes well.
Yeah,
and I may get hate for this. Into the Night does not handle its tonal changes well at all.
Right,
like
I would agree with that. Yeah. I mean, if you watch the movie, I think anybody would agree with that.
Like the Iranian characters, which one of them is played by John Landis, are often portrayed as kind of like Keystone Cop-esque Three Stooges physical comedy characters.
Right.
They're meant to be kind of a joke, but two or three times in the movie, they savagely murder someone.
Yeah.
Like, violently.
Like, in the opening scene. Well, when you first see them, they savagely stab that guy.
Yeah, the guy who Michelle Pfeiffer's with in the beginning. And it seems way more serious than how they're portrayed later on, because later on, they're kind of portrayed like the Three Stooges. They're kind of dopey, but then about halfway through the film, they kill someone else again savagely. And you know, there's all these moments where it'll get suddenly violent, and it feels at odds with the rest of this movie, which is kind of a Shaggy Dog sort of hangout movie.
Yeah.
Of just Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer just driving through the city at night, running into random people.
Yeah, and in L.A., like in a, you know, they were in the guy that plays Elvis, the like her brother or whatever. I can't remember what his name is.
Pull it up right quick.
But he was fantastic. I mean, yeah, I thought
he is a good character actor. So let me pull up his name so we can give him a shout out.
Yeah. I mean, Michelle Pfeiffer was fantastic in this movie, and I think that this was a very early movie for Michelle Pfeiffer, and I think that you can tell like who she was as an actor.
It's the great Bruce McGill who plays her.
Bruce McGill,
who is in a ton of movies.
Yes, he is in a ton of movies.
He is. He's in The Last Boy Scout. How do we free Bruce McGill as the Last Boy Scout?
I mean, because doesn't he get killed off in the
last one? Yeah. No, he's his buddy.
Oh, yeah, his buddy. Yeah.
Head or gut, you know?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
He plays Bruce Willis's antithesis.
He's in Time Cop and A Perfect World. I mean, there were some really great movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's one thing that's interesting about this film. This movie is filled with basically John Landis's buddies.
Yeah.
I mean, and some of them you're going to recognize because they're character actors or they're really big name people like Jim Henson.
Right.
Or David Bowie.
To go back to my point, though, yeah. I mean, there's a point where like, and David Bowie plays an awesome character. Yeah. And I would love to have seen him play that character more, but he was only in it for a brief moment.
He's in two scenes, and both the scenes he's in are great. If he had been the main villain of the film, this would be one of my all-time favorite movies, I think, because the scenes he's in are great. Like, there's a scene where he just suddenly appears and he threatens Jeff Goldblum by putting a gun in his mouth, just nonchalantly, like it's the most normal thing in the world. He shoves a gun in Jeff Goldblum's mouth, and it's interesting. It's kind of badass, and it's weirdly funny,
right?
And then later on, he shows up again, trying to get these emeralds, and you see that he's murdered a room full of people. And he's wielding a knife, and he's just a very kind of cool, intimidating bad guy, but he's really only in those two scenes.
Yeah, but when he puts the gun into Goldblum's mouth, I mean, Goldblum is like, you know, it's almost like he's pretending that it's not there.
Yeah.
Like, he's not really, like, he doesn't react like somebody has a gun in his mouth.
Yeah.
He's not acting with, you know, and I say acting, but I mean, his character's not showing any sort of excitement or fear of his life.
So what you're saying is you didn't feel that was realistic, and that took you out of it.
Yeah, and I thought it was like, okay. So, and that, I mean, I get it. I mean, Landis is trying to make a comedic thing here. He's trying to show that, you know, I get where he's going with it, right? I get he's trying to, like, say that this person hasn't slept in like 3 days.
So nothing's phasing him.
Yeah, so nothing's really phasing him out. This guy's got his gun in his mouth. He's like, okay, all right then. I guess that's what's going to happen now. And that's the way his character is, because it's just like, you don't know at that point with being awake. I mean, even being awake for 24 hours or more, you know, you're up like 32, 40. Things get really weird.
Yeah.
And then, like, by, you know, the third day, they have to be even more weird.
Yeah.
And that's where he's trying to go, but I don't know. I guess I just wasn't really with him.
Yeah. I think that worked for me because of the charisma of David Bowie and because I like Jeff Goldblum. And so those scenes worked for me. I wish there had been more of that kind of stuff.
Right.
Like I said, a lot of these cameos, what I was getting at a moment ago, a lot of these cameos are not going to matter to your casual watcher, because they're not going to know who some of these people are.
Yeah.
Some of these cameos are neat if you're a film fan or really into music.
Right.
Like you and I.
I think I would have got it more if it was, if like you said, if it was more outlandish instead of being a little more vicious. Like, you know what I mean?
It walks this weird line of trying to be silly but still being sort of straight.
Right.
And it just doesn't quite work for me.
And you want to root for the characters. You want to be on their side, but you don't know really enough about the situation of how to get out of it. So it's like you can't even really see the way out. They can't even really see the way out. So, I mean, then she keeps talking about this Jack character. You don't know how Jack is involved.
And you don't meet this Jack guy until the 30th. You mention this guy who's going to help her, who she's trying to help from. You don't see this character until the third act. You're like, why do I care about this guy?
Yeah.
And then he becomes the deus ex machina that basically saves them at the end.
Yeah.
And it's so unearned.
Yeah.
And
it's Richard Farnsworth. I mean, what do you
Well, no. I mean, he's good. I mean, he's good. He's great.
He's awesome, yeah.
But, I mean, the way the script is written,
yeah,
it feels so unearned. Because he just suddenly pops up. It really is. It's like the Deus Ex Machina. He shows up and like suddenly everything's okay.
Right.
Like he basically snaps his fingers and you know all the problems are solved, and it feels like such a cheat after everything else.
Right.
And
very true.
And so that coupled with the fact that the movie has weird tone issues, and you don't really, and I just say this, I didn't care what happened.
Right. I mean, well, the end you want, like, they tried to tie in like Goldblum and well, I mean, we keep saying I need to go back. They keep tying Ed and Diana is like this love interest, but really he's just trying to keep up with her.
Yeah.
And they don't, it doesn't really seem like they have a lot of chemistry, and then but all of a sudden it, like, they get a lot of money at the end.
Yeah.
You know, Jack gives them like this big barrel full of cash, but then they can't leave the hotel room.
Yeah.
And then he finally falls asleep. And then he wakes up. There's just a little bit of money, and then she's gone.
Yeah. And then, but then she was surprised. She popped back like up right before the credits to have a happy ending.
He walks out of the hall, finds the like person cleaning up the rooms, is like, hey, did you see this woman? Did you see this woman? And she's like, what? I don't understand. You know, because she speaks a different language, and then he turns around and there's
with like luggage.
Yeah,
and it's meant to be like.
And then she says, "Can I get a ride to the airport?"
Yeah, and so it's meant to be a happy ending, but it feels really unearned. And the whole, to me, the only reason it doesn't fall apart at all is because Michelle Pfeiffer and Jeff Goldblum are good actors. You know,
yeah,
they make it work purely through their own talent, not because of what the script or the directing does for them.
I agree.
I think we're gonna get hate mail for this one.
Maybe.
But I will say this movie does have Carl Perkins knife fighting with David Bowie.
All right. Stop right there.
Okay.
All right. There is a list, and when the person mentions a cavalcade of cameos, okay?
Yeah.
It is.
Yes.
Do you want me to read you the whole list?
I think it's interesting. Let's do it.
All right. We're going to read, because movie fans, you will be so interested to hear the amount of people that you may or may not have heard of, but you've at least heard of some of the movies they've done. Okay? Jack Arnold, he directed It Came From Outer Space, is the man with the dog in the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Baker, the Academy Award-winning makeup artist on American Werewolf in London.
And The Thing.
Is the drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Bartel, director of low-budget films, including Eating Raoul, is the Beverly Wilshire Hotel
doorman.
That's
a good movie.
David Cronenberg. Director of body horror films and a movie that we did.
That starred Jeff Goldblum.
They probably met
on this film.
Yes. The Fly, because The Fly was done in 86.
Mm-hmm.
One year later. So now you have the connection between where Dave Cronenberg and Jeff Goldblum.
That's likely where they met.
Yeah.
You know, Cronenberg is a surprisingly decent actor. He shows up every now and then and stuff as an actor. He's surprisingly good.
Yeah, he played Ed's supervisor in the boardroom.
It's a small scene, but he's convincing.
Yeah, he was great. I didn't even know it was him. Anyway, Jonathan Demme. What did he do?
I don't remember which role he was in the
film.
He's
directed a number of low-budget and exploitation films.
What did he direct? He's directed all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Well, which part did he play in the film?
The thin federal agent with glasses.
I did not realize that was Jonathan Demme.
Yeah. Richard Franklin, Australian director of Road Games, as the aerospace engineer sitting next to Herb. Mm-hmm.
And Road Games is a great Jamie Lee Curtis movie, which I actually recommend that we do if we want to go back to do horror films.
Yeah.
Or we want to do movies about Australian exploitation. That's a good one.
Yeah, it's good. Carl Gottlieb, who co-wrote Jaws, is the large federal agent with a mustache. Amy Heckerling, director of Fast Times at Ridgemont High, as Amy, the clumsy waitress. Jim Henson, the creator of the Muppets, as the man on the phone talking to Bernie.
Yeah.
That was just weird seeing Jim Henson in this
movie. And what's odd about
it's like so like out of place.
Well, what's odd about these cameos, I don't know if they're more noticeable, if they're more recognizable at the time.
Yeah.
But the camera will linger on them from like you're supposed to be like, hey, it's Amy Heckerling.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know what Amy Heckerling looks like. I didn't know that was her until I saw the cast list.
Colin Higgins, who wrote Harold and Maude and directed The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, was as the actor in the Hostage film.
Those are both pretty good movies.
Lawrence Kasdan, writer and director of Body Heat, and also wrote
Continental Divide,
yeah. the movie that we did here on this show, as the police detective who interrogates Bud.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Lynn, co-writer of Yes, Minister, as the tailor who fits the Savick agents.
Which is a pretty funny scene.
Yeah. Paul Marzuski, director of Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and an unmarried woman is Bud Herman, the beach house owner and accused drug dealer. Carl Perkins, rockabilly musician and composer of Blue Suede Shoes, is Mr. Williams.
He was like a bodyguard for one of the gangsters in the film. But yeah, I want to digress for a moment again and repeat. If you watch this, if it sounds like it's something you still want to watch, if this movie sounds like something you still want to watch, then keep in mind again, David Bowie and Carl Perkins have a knife fight.
All right, we got six more.
Yeah.
Dano Petrie, director of Raisin in the Sun, is director of the Hostage film. Dee Dee Pfeiffer, actress and sister of Michelle Pfeiffer, as the hooker. Waldo Scott, Academy Award-winning screenwriter of Midnight Cowboy, as the derelict who informs Ed of his car being towed. Don Siegel, director of Invasion of body the body snatchers.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Thank you. And Dirty Harry is the man who caught the girl in the bathroom. Jake Steinfeld as a small role, Larry Jack Cap.
Which
Jack
to explain, Jake Steinfeld is the workout guru who did Body by Jake in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, man. Roger Vadim, director of And God Created Woman and Barbarella, is Monsieur Melville, the French kidnapper, and Lou Marini, saxophonist. Lou Marini is in the airport crowd. We also mentioned David Bowie. But David Bowie was not in a lot of films. He did a lot of soundtracks, but he did very few films. I mean, this was before Labyrinth, even.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did probably, I don't know, I'm not going to look it up, but probably about six or seven, so not many.
Yeah.
Which is a shame because he's really good in everything he's in.
He really is. Yeah. He really is. I really enjoyed, like I said, you could have done like a whole like movie on him.
If it had been David Bowie chasing Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer through L.A., this would have been like my favorite movie of all time.
Yes.
But as it stands right now, Into the Night to me is a very frustrating film, which I kind of like. But I don't like enough to really recommend it to anyone.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about Quick Change.
A movie that I honestly love.
Quick Change was, I mean, we'll just go ahead and say it as far as like the facts. It was co-directed.
Co-directed by Howard Franklin and Bill Murray.
Yeah. The only directing credit for Bill Murray. The only producing credit for Bill Murray. So he produced it himself, but he's a co-director and an actor in the film.
Yes.
And this basically, as far as the synopsis, it's about a bank robbery and the escape. Yes. That's it.
The bank robbery that takes place in New York, and then they try to flee from New York. And of course, everything goes wrong.
So, but that's, to me, it's almost like two sort of movies.
Yes.
The bank robbery itself. And then the escape.
Yes. And the movie is almost divided, almost in half, by that.
Right.
The bank robbery is really the more iconic part of the film because Bill Murray robs the bank dressed like a very ridiculous clown.
Yeah.
He's got full makeup, a wig, like balloons.
And a bad looking like one. One where he didn't really like secure the wig correctly.
Yeah.
You know, where you can still see his skin like kind of popping out from the thing.
If any of you viewers out there ever saw the Bobcat Goldthwait classic Shakes the Clown, he looks like he would fit right in with like the alcoholic clowns and Shakes the Clown. He looks like a disheveled like party clown who's just mad at the world, basically.
Yeah.
And he basically goes into this bank and robs it with a really fun and convoluted plan that's honestly pretty well thought out. We're not going to go too deep into spoilers because we don't want to just rehash the plot
for
you.
But basically, the plan is real simple. Is basically like he's going to make all these he knows that the cops are going to come. He's not going to be able to get out with the money. So that the cops are, you know, he's going to take everybody hostage. And then he's going to ask for all these like crazy demands.
Yeah.
And then, for the demands, he releases one hostage. Well, couple of the people in the bank are already like his accomplices.
Yeah, he's got two plants in the bank played by Randy Quaid and the luminous And I say she luminous.
Geena Davis.
Geena Davis.
Oh my gosh.
Like she's, and I've said this before, she's probably the, she is gorgeous in this film. Like, I mean, her acting is wonderful, but she is, like, you know, she'll make your jaw drop. She's so beautiful in this movie.
This movie was done in 1990. Mm-hmm. And might I add also that this movie, we have Jeff Goldblum, we did Into the Night, so that's Jeff Goldblum, and then Geena Davis is in this film, who were also once a dating when they did The Fly in 1986.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about how just, you know, wonderful Geena Davis was during The Fly as well. But again,
and this is like 4 years later or something like that. And Geena Davis was also in Fletch. Mm-hmm. Can't forget that.
That's right. She was. Yeah.
But yeah, she is like exceptional in this movie. And this is where she's like, you know, going, like, trying to take roles, trying to take more and bigger roles, I think, you know.
But, yeah, her and Randy Quaid, before he went crazy, are Bill Murray's accomplices.
Sorry.
So, no, it's we had some technical difficulties.
Technical difficulties.
So, yeah, they're basically his accomplices inside the bank. So, when they start dropping off his crazy demands.
We're good. What'd you got? Did you lose me?
Okay, I think I've got you now. Sorry.
Okay.
I lost you for a moment.
Okay.
We're leaving all this in. there is his accomplice in the bank. So when they drop off the stuff, his crazy demands, he basically takes off his clown gear and sneaks out with him as if he's a hostage.
Right.
And they basically slip into the city.
Well, the reason that they slip out, we have to tell them why, is because they're the ones carrying the money.
Yeah.
He's taping the money to him.
Yeah, basically, he tapes the money to himself and to his two accomplices. That's how they sneak out with the money with no one noticing. Like, they wear baggy clothes.
Yeah.
And they tape it really close to their bodies.
Yeah.
And they get out with I think they said it was $1 million.
$1 million, yeah.
Yeah. Which, if their bills were high, it wouldn't be that much.
Yeah.
But, so they get away, and their plan is to get to the airport and fly away before anyone ever realizes they're gone.
Right.
But, as they're teasing the cops as they're getting away, Randy Quaid accidentally bumps a horn on a car.
Mm-hmm.
So the cops hear the horn in the background and realize they're not in the bank anymore.
Yeah.
And that starts the chase of the cops trying to figure out where they're at.
Yeah.
And as they're trying to get away and stay ahead of the cops, literally everything goes wrong as they try to get to the airport.
Yeah.
And the head of the police is played by Jason Robards,
mm-hmm.
who is wonderful in this movie. He's such a great antagonist. Because he's not played as the villain.
Mm-hmm.
He's played as a good cop who's competent. Like he's not portrayed like he's an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
He actually figures things out in a logical way. Mm-hmm. And he's just trying to do a good job. And they actually talk about what a good cop he is throughout the movie. But he's not portrayed as the villain.
Right. And Jason Robards, for some of our audiences, may recognize him from another more popular movie, especially for anybody my age or maybe a little bit younger. It's a movie called Parenthood. And he plays like the patriarch, you know, grandfather, you know, like the of the family. He's like the older gentleman and in this movie he is just as awesome, just as poignant, and just as like you know, I mean, words can't really describe how on top of things that he is and how wise like he is.
Like, think about how good an actor you have to be to try to arrest Geena Davis and Bill Murray and not come across like the villain and someone you hate.
Right.
Like, he actually has the role that should be thankless and makes you care about it and kind of want him to succeed in his own way. You want someone for every character to get what they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want anyone to lose in this scenario.
Right.
That's up to great writing and good acting.
Well, and these actors, too, like I think about people like Jason Robards and, you know, and I think about even like Randy Quaid, and you have these big actors like Geena Davis and you have, you know, like Bill Murray. It would be so easy to like either understage or upstage them.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's one of the reasons why the movie works so well, because that doesn't happen.
No.
It's balanced so well.
Yeah, it does really balance. Now, I thought Randy Quaid was a little over the top in a few scenes.
Yeah, but it's almost like he has to be that way to kind of further the concept of the movie where he's the reason everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
More than once. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But even he's given moments of like normalcy. Like, he has little aside moments with Geena Davis where he's just a normal guy. They're talking about their hopes and fears.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gina Davis is in love with Bill Murray's character.
Right.
So Randy Quaid's character.
But she starts questioning whether she trusts him or not, yeah. You know, because he did things outside the plan, like get extra plane tickets or whatever. Yeah. And she's like pregnant with, you know,
his baby. Which is an extra subplot.
But she hasn't told him yet.
Yeah, which is an extra subplot. And this is all kind of played out in like little very, very kind of human, very realistic asides. While this other kind of zany stuff is happening around them.
Yeah.
And to me, that also makes it better than Into the Night, because Into the Night had none of those kind of real character moments.
Mm-hmm.
No one felt like a real person in Into the Night.
Well, like I meant, I guess I said it, but I didn't really say it specifically about, you know, the Diana and, you know, Ed falling in love. You know, you don't really buy in, you know, to the end of them falling in love, other than the great acting by Michelle Pfeiffer and Jeff Goldblum.
And then the movie wants them to be in love.
There's not a real character development between that love interest, you know?
Yeah.
There's none of that.
Yeah, but you feel the fact that Gina Davis loves Bill Murray.
Yeah.
Bill Murray loves her. And that Loomis, played by Randy Quaid, even though he's an idiot, is their best friend.
Right.
And they care about him.
And even though that he's like a total screw up and probably not somebody they would have picked for the job, you know, and I thought about this, you know, like realistically, like, you know, we sit back and go, could this really happen? Like, why did they really do this? Why did they really pick this guy? Because it's like, it's crazy to try to rob the bank this way. It really is. Yeah. I mean, and who else are you going to convince to do this and to go in into this with you? Like, well, you know what I mean?
And one thing they mentioned is that Bill Murray's character and Randy Quaid's character were friends since they were children.
Yeah.
So you got the idea that Bill Murray really trusted him.
Well, and he knew all of his like weird quirks and hang-ups and was willing to like kind of accept that and kind of take care of him or whatever.
But again, there's some real character work that makes them feel like three-dimensional characters, which is really missing from the other film. That's one of the reasons why Quick Change is so good.
Well, let's talk about Bill Murray as like the sort of leading man and con man.
This almost is like if I had to give someone an example of why Bill Murray's great, I might show them this performance. He is everything in this movie. He is cool. He is confident. He is witty. He's sarcastic. You know,
he still has moments of vulnerability.
Yes, and it's such a good performance.
You know, because in like Ghostbusters, it's like every scene that he's in, he's like the most confident guy in the room. But like when they walk into it wasn't a garage.
It was Gina Davis's old apartment.
No, not the apartment. I'm talking about when they met up with the gangsters.
Oh, they run into gangsters because, again, in One Crazy Night films, you run into random odd characters. And we're going to get into some of the weird like cameos in this movie.
Yeah.
But continue.
But, they walk into like the mob scene, right, where they got like the gangsters in there. You know, he doesn't look that confident. You know, he's kind of like questioning, like, what's really going on? Like, where am I going? And even at one time, Phyllis.
Which Gina is Gina Davis' character, yeah.
Looks at him and says, what are you doing? He goes, I don't know. You know?
But you can tell, he's kind of snaps back into trying to act confident. And it's a good performance because you buy that he's playing it confident. He's convincing them. But you know, on the inside, he's not.
Right.
And it's a good performance because you can see those layers of insecurity and then fake confidence on top of it. It's a remarkable performance. I think it may be Bill Murray's best performance.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree. I think part of the charm of this movie, though, is not just the directing, not just the acting, the character development, all of that. I mean, you have to remember this was adapted from a book.
Mm-hmm.
That was written in like 1981 or something like that. And this
but the guy's last name was Conray. I think it was John. I can look it up.
It's in my notes.
But I believe it's John Conray.
It's in my notes here. I have it because it's Jay Cronley.
Jay Cronley. I apologize. We're leaving that in too.
Jay Cronley.
And the book is called Quick Change.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. They made an adaptation of
it. Oh, yeah, it is.
They made a French adaptation of it called Hold Up.
Yes.
But surprisingly, the book is very similar to the film. The book's the film is a little more lighthearted than the book.
Yeah.
But it's a very close adaptation.
Yeah, but that's my point. My point is, it was, you know, it's not written by them. It was written by, but still, I think Bill Murray chose to, you know, stick with that and stick yeah. with the development of the characters. And I think that, you know, when we look at other movies that he did, like he really likes that realistic character development, yeah. you know, where people have heart. And the weird thing about this movie, and I'll say this, sometimes you don't even know who to root for. Because yeah. sometimes you're rooting for Bill Murray,
yeah.
and then sometimes you're rooting for, you know, the chief
yeah.
to catch them. So it's almost yeah. like there's like kind of a push-pull because yeah. the chief is like, he's very smart. He's very yeah. on top of it.
And they illustrate he's a good cop and a good person and, who's done good things.
And this is his last thing. Like, he's
yeah.
retiring.
Yeah, he's retiring, yeah.
Yeah. And he wants to be remembered as this great guy, and this was going to be his last like
yeah.
thing that he's going to yeah. you know, try to accomplish yeah. or whatever yeah, as a chief.
And again, unlike Into the Night, because we have to compare them, I cared about what happened the entire time.
Right.
Like, I wanted to know who was going to win up until the very last moment.
Yeah.
And well, I got to say, I don't want to give away the ending, because I think the movie's totally worth watching and I love it. But they do a great job of giving both characters a win where they can keep their dignity and send yeah. the audience, I'm happy.
Yeah.
In a way that feels fairly organic.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a weird ending. It's kind of a, but I mean, once again, it shows off like the, you know, the sort of confidence con yeah. man sort of character,
yeah.
but also lovable leading man yeah. of Bill Murray.
Yeah.
You know, playing this guy named Grimm, you know, who can just play off all of these things happening, you know, and here's the chief and here's the guy that's chasing him and he's playing it off, you know.
Like it's no big deal.
Like it's nothing. And he's like, they're standing there right next yeah. to each other on the plane.
And you know. Can tell, again, Bill Murray's panicked, but he's not showing it. Again, nope. It's a very layered performance. And again, the ending's a little contrived, but there's so much good before that before the resolution that you don't care that it's a little contrived because you just like the movie so much up until that point. But to go back to the comparisons, this movie also has a ton of people in it that you would recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they were famous at the time, but there are people in this movie who went on to be very famous.
Tony Shalhoub plays the cab driver.
Mm-hmm, the cab driver who doesn't speak English, who right. you know from Monk.
From Monk.
Wings.
From Wings, from Man in Black.
Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, so, and then also Phil Hartman.
The great Phil Hartman.
The great and wonderful. Every time, and I told you this before yeah. when we were doing the prep, every time I see Phil Hartman in a movie, and I'm you know, I wasn't expecting it in this movie. I didn't look up anything. I just like, I knew the three main characters were yeah. in it, and I just watched it. And every time he comes on screen, it makes my heart sink a little yeah. bit because
you suddenly remember what happened.
It suddenly brings you back to his tragic death, and yeah. you're like, man, yeah. and you just, but you just enjoy his performance and go, gosh, he is so great.
Yeah. I feel very lucky that he did so much work before the untimely and that we have his work to enjoy.
Yeah.
And he's great in this and his one scene.
Right.
And then you've got Kurtwood Smith, who was in that 70s show yep. and RoboCop. And, yeah. You've got Stanley Tucci playing a mobster at one point.
Yep.
Just, I mean, so many great character actors who went on to be very, very big.
Yeah. But I will say this is not like a laugh out loud
no.
kind of funny movie. It's kind of a, you know, kind of a quirky comedy.
Yeah.
But it stays with the quirky. It yeah. doesn't get real like serious no. like Into the Night does.
No.
It just stays in that weird sort of comedic kind of quality.
Yeah, it's fun. You like all the characters, so you want to hang out with them.
Yeah.
And literally, you like every main character.
Yeah.
So the movie's just a fun watch.
Yeah, like I said, you don't know who to really root for.
And it never gets too silly. It never gets too dark.
Yeah.
It's like it's at this sweet spot where it's just fun.
Yeah.
And to me, Quick Change is one of those movies that's really a lot. It doesn't get a lot of hype.
Yeah.
To me, it's a lost classic. I think the film is damn near perfect for what it is.
Okay.
No exaggeration.
Yeah, I mean, that's putting it a little much. I mean,
no, if I was going to rate it out of 5 stars, I'd give it 4.5, and only 4.5 because the ending's a little contrived.
Okay.
I believe that. I mean, I think this movie is a movie.
I will have to say, though, in 1990, you still have to watch the movie from like a 1990 perspective of being able to get from one place to the next.
Oh, yeah.
In dealing with things like a fold-out map.
Yes.
Or dealing with things like public transit And
yeah, no one knows where anything is in this film.
Right, yeah, and having the exact change for the bus, for the bus fare. I mean, you do have to kind of, like, remember, and it kind of shows, like, sort of, like, New York City and the absurdity of trying to get around New York City around
that time period. Yeah. Because this movie wouldn't exist if Google Maps was a thing.
No, it wouldn't. I mean, and it would be hard to sort of, like, you know, write today, because you would have to you'd have
cell phones and Uber
but
again, for the time period and for the time it exists in, I think it's so well constructed, it's so well done. I love this movie, and I told you even before we started, like, I was excited to watch this one again and get to talk about it, because to me, this is one of those kind of movies that I think has been kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
And that's this kind of movie is why we do this show.
I would have really have liked in this movie, I think the one sort of missing ingredient that it's missing is that the scene, like, you open with Bill Murray in this clown costume, like, robbing a bank, and you're not, like, let in on whatever. You're not let it. You don't know. And that's part of the fun of the movie. I get that. I get, like,
there's some discovery really, in the beginning.
Discovery. Yeah. But I think that if you let audiences kind of in on things beforehand, it would make you more connected near the end.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, because it's like, because it's two movies, it's kind of like you're almost rooting for the cop at first, and then the second one you're kind of rooting for, the bank robber. So it's kind of like, it's really sort of weird how it's constructed to me. Yeah. And that's why I was just like, kind of like, where is this going? What's going to happen with it? Because I could really easily see either two scenarios. I was like, either they're going to get away with it and the cops are going to, like, be off the trail and they're just going to get, like, you know,
they're going to get embarrassed.
They're going to get embarrassed, or they're going to get busted some other way. You know what I mean? By some other means.
And it'll end with Bill Murray in jail.
Yeah. Or like you can see some of the scenes kind of going one, like when they're with the gangsters kind of like turning against them, or when the guy, what was it? The weirdo guy that was trying to pick up people or whatever. That they got directions from, they got the map from, or whatever.
Oh, they run into another criminal who's a thief. Yeah,
right.
Who basically steals their luggage and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, what are you? It's kind of like that. That's where I thought that would kind of like, they wouldn't, like, the cops wouldn't be involved. So yeah, it's just kind of weird to me to kind of follow it all. And really, as much as I like the Bill Murray magic, I don't know. I guess I didn't really feel as much sort of magic as some of his other films.
Well, and that's cool, man. We, you know, we're not always going to agree on things, but it's okay to be wrong. But
well, he doesn't. He kind of downplays the character a little bit. I think. I mean, I don't know if that has to do with because he directed it and wasn't really pushed, or you know what I'm saying.
Like, I can kind of see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, I think
it was kind of a lackadaisical in some scenes that I didn't really feel real connected to.
I think your criticisms are valid, and I can see where you're coming from. I just don't agree with them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. I know you love it and you think it's like perfect.
I think it's close to perfect. It does have some flaws.
Yeah.
But I think for what it is, for what it's trying to do, I think it's wonderful. I think any Bill Murray fan should definitely see this. If you've never seen any and you love Bill Murray, like we love Bill Murray, it's a must watch for his performance alone. If you love Gina Davis, or you don't know why Gina Davis is wonderful, this maybe a good movie to show you why she's wonderful and why we, you know, hype her up so much, because she's great in this.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah,
she is fantastic.
And Randy Quaid is Randy Quaid, and you know he's.
Yeah, I didn't really get I. To be quite honest, I could have dealt without his character.
Yeah. He could have been dialed down a little bit.
Yeah. He was a little bit too, I don't know if it was just overacting or just too outlandish. It was just like, it was a bit too much to take after a while. Like, you just wanted to, you almost wanted to just like push him, like punch him in the face. Like, and after they got out of after they got out, it's like, why do we even need him anymore? Yeah. You know, he's the one that's getting us in, you know, that keeps getting us in trouble. Yeah. Here, take this money, get out of here.
Yeah.
You know, figure it out on your own. But I digress. All right. So let's go through the facts.
Okay. Let's do it.
Ready? Wait. Are we going to do the keep it or
well,
return
yeah.
it? Or are
well,
we going to
yeah,
wait
let's,
till the
well,
end?
Let's go and do that now. That's a good point. Right. One day we'll get the format down, ladies and gentlemen.
One of these days.
So let's say Let's go back to Into the Night.
If you rented Into the Night
from the video store, would you keep it an extra day and pay the late fees, or would you get it back on time?
Get it back on time.
Because you don't want to pay an extra time for it.
No.
Yeah, I don't really want to watch
weird.
It. I don't want to watch it again, sadly. That makes me sad.
It does.
A movie with Jeff Goldblum and David Bowie that I don't want to watch again, that has nude scenes with Michelle Pfeiffer that I just don't want to watch again.
What scenes?
She's nude in the movie a couple times.
Who?
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, you don't really see.
Well, that's a digression we don't want to get into, but I'm saying it's sad that it has all that stuff in it.
Your back or something.
It has all that stuff in it, yet I don't want to rewatch it. So that, to me, is pretty telling.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Jeff Goldblum movie. Yeah, I don't want to see it. Quick Change. Yeah, we're keeping that movie.
Yeah, I love Quick Change. No, I mean, no joke. I wholeheartedly love that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I would steal it from the video store and keep it on my shelf.
Steal it. Yeah. If it were DivX, you would convert it to a platinum or gold disc or whatever.
That's an obscure reference.
Or silver disc.
Yeah, that's a reference to our previous podcast. If you guys don't know what he's talking about, listen to our podcast on format.
Yeah,
located at video-culture.com in our episode archives.
Episode 16. All right, so Into the Night. So counting John Landis, we talked about the amount of the people and directors and whoever that are in this movie, counting John Landis, who is also in the movie, there are 17 directors that make an appearance in the film. 17. It was also said, I'll just go ahead and bring this up now, it was theorized that this is a time that John Landis was kind of in trouble for a shooting, accidental shooting that happened on a Twilight Zone episode.
He was dealing with the accidental death that happened on the Twilight Zone movie, which I don't really want to go into that. I mean, if you want to know about
But part of it, people say that he had all of these people show up in the movie as a show of support for John Landis because he was being investigated.
Yeah, because they thought that actors died because of his negligence in the Twilight Zone movie. If you guys are interested in that, I highly recommend Googling it. It's a sad story. But if you want to know more about John Landis' history, it's worth reading if you're curious. But it is a pretty sad story.
Yeah. So, but moving on, Jack Nicholson was offered the film of Ed Oken, but turned it down. And he basically turned it down because he was just like, the character didn't really do much.
It's true.
Why would people fall in love with this character? It didn't really do much. Jeff Goldblum earned the part of Ed due to his role in The Big Chill, which was written by Lawrence Kasdan, who's also in the film, where the studio had cast to Tom Berenger or Kevin Kline. So basically, after neither were available, they settled on Goldblum.
Which I think the energy makes more sense for Kevin Kline.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, I like
he
Goldblum
plays a
more.
Straight man a lot better.
Yes, he does. Because you want Goldblum to be quirky. You do.
Right.
And maybe that's me pigeonholing him, and that's unfair, but that's just what I enjoy about my Goldblum.
Yeah. John Landis had cast Jamie Lee Curtis for the role of Diana.
With her and Kevin Kline, it might have been a movie that worked
Yeah, because
better.
He liked her in Trading Places.
Makes sense, yeah. Which she's, of course, great in that.
But, like, yeah, why would she do it? She's already played a character like that in Trading Places.
That's a good point, yeah.
So, she went on to play in another movie. Which I don't have the name of that movie. Airport scenes in the film, including and also in the movie Coming to America, that was filmed in 1988, that was also done by John Landis, have a call over the PA system for a Mr. Frank Oskarowitz to pick up a white courtesy telephone. This is a reference to Frank Oz, who always makes an appearance in John Landis's films. Although Frank Oz's real last name is Osnowitz, Oznowwicz, not Oskarowitz.
And I guess because Frank couldn't do it, that's why he got Henson to be in it.
I guess.
Yeah, just a little bit of puppet, solidarity there.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah,
I guess. The hooker played by Michelle Pfeiffer. Well, I mean, he's called on the white courtesy telephone, so
that's true.
The hooker that Michelle Pfeiffer we just said was her sister, her young sister Dee Dee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's kind of. I didn't even know that.
They kind of look because thinking back on it, they bear resemblance for sure. Yeah.
The score for Into the Night was written by Ira Newborn, who also wrote scores for Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Weird Science, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Uncle Buck, Mallrats, The Blues Brothers. So he wrote the Into the Night and My Lucille that were performed by B.B. King. The
score is good.
Yeah.
Score of Into the Night.
I mean, the song that B.B. King wrote, I mean, it's fantastic,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
Like, you hear the intro song and you see, like, you know, Goldblum, you know, driving around or whatever in the credits, and you're like, man, this is a cool film.
Yeah.
You would think that it's really awesome. And when the credits started rolling, I was like, man, this looks like it's going to be cool.
Yeah, and then it just becomes like, okay, which is always, you know, nothing's worse than a movie that just kind of disappoints you. So, it's not really bad, but it just disappoints you.
So, yeah, the coolest part of the whole movie, the intro credits.
I'd agree with that. Well, and David Bowie.
And David Bowie.
Yeah.
All right. Despite negative reviews, John Landis is very pleased with the movie. He says, Into the Night was my first box office failure, and that was quite surprising to me because I haven't done anything different. It was dark. And that's another thing. Critics don't like when you F with the genre. It's the opposite of high concept. High concept is when you can explain the movie in one sentence, but when things get muddled, they're confused. I like Into the Night. It's got a wonderful cast.
Yeah, they're all his friends. Of course, he didn't like the cast.
Of course. The budget was of $8 million, and it grossed $7.5
million. Wow, that's, yeah.
So, I mean,
That's barely, that's not quite breaking even. That is kind of sad, considering.
I mean, it really does. I mean, if you watch it, it kind of feels like a John Landis, like, student film or something.
It feels shaggy.
Yeah.
It's definitely loose, and it's not nearly, because Quick Change has some shagginess to it as well, but it's a much tighter film.
Yeah. Roger Ebert gave it 1 star.
I saw that he hated it. I don't normally look at his reviews ahead of time before we do these, but I saw that he hated this one.
He wrote, if I had been the agent for one of the stars like Goldblum, Michelle Pfeiffer, Richard Farnsworth, or Catherine Harold, I think I would have protested to the front office that Landis was engaging in cinematic autoeroticism and that my clients were getting lost in the middle of the family reunion.
That's some savagery right there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's just like there's a certain point, though, you know, to me where it's like the cameos just get a little bit too much.
Well, and they don't.
And where they don't make sense. And
they're not going to make, make sense to anyone who doesn't know who all those people are. Like a 20-year-old watching it today is going to be like, why is the camera lingering on that guy or this girl?
Like, yeah, why do they care about this guy is getting a phone call from Bernie?
Like, this waitress dropped something.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird in that respect.
Yeah. Quick Change. I'm already moving on to Quick Change. This is how bad this is. Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 38% critics score and a 49% audience score.
The 49% audience score seems fairer to me because it's not terrible. It's just.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what a 50% is.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The audience score I agree with. Critics score seems a little harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Critics always expect more out of movies.
Yeah. Though. Well. As a film journalist, I definitely understand that.
Well, and there's probably more films that are harshly graded by critics that have a higher audience score than movies that have a high critic score and a lower audience score.
Well, and critics are paid to kind of nitpick.
Yeah,
that's true.
Quick Change. All right, so moving on to Quick Change. Quick Change is the only director or producer credit Bill Murray. We already said that. So it was written by, so it was also directed, co-directed by Howard Franklin, who did this, this great neo-noir film that we need to add to the list called The Public Eye.
Yeah.
Starring Joe Pesci.
I've never seen it. I've only seen the trailer.
Yeah. And also he, directed another Bill Murray film, The Man Who Knew Too Little.
That's actually a parody of those same kind of films.
Yeah,
and it's good. It's a, you know, I've seen that. I like that movie.
So Quick Change is based on the novel called Quick Change by Jay Cronley from Oklahoma. He's like in the Oklahoma like Writers Hall of Fame.
Hmm.
So he wrote a lot of like weird, quirky sort of novels. Some of them have been made into movies. This was first made into a movie you mentioned before in 1985. It was a French-Canadian film called Hold Up.
Mm-hmm.
But Montreal was like the scene instead of New York was the setting. And also, he also wrote a movie called, or wrote a book called Good Vibes that became a movie called Let It Ride in 1989, which starred Richard Dreyfuss and Terry Garr.
That's pretty random.
It is really random, but I mean, it's another one of his novels. I mean, he only wrote like, I mean, there was like, I looked on the page, like 8 or 9 like books.
Yeah.
One of the other movies you will recognize, Funny Farm.
Oh, he did Funny Farm?
Yeah, he wrote Funny Farm, and that was filmed in 1988 starring Chevy Chase. Yeah.
Which, it's not a great movie, but it's a movie that I kind of like.
Yeah. So we have to think, why did Bill Murray and Howard Franklin co-direct? I mean, you'd think that he made this choice on his own, right?
Yeah. I bet you that Howard directed all the scenes where Bill Murray couldn't focus on what was going on, like the scenes where he was too intrinsically involved in the scene.
But why did he choose to direct in the first place?
I don't know.
So I found out. So basically, they wanted to get a director. He wanted to get a director. He approached Ron Howard. He turned it down because he felt there was no character to root for, which is what I kind of thought. You know?
I kind of have the opposite of me where I think you root for every character, but that's me.
Well, yes, but you don't really root for one whole character. You may say you got a little bit invested in here, a little bit invested in here, but there's no one character that you can really go, I'm rooting for that guy. I'm following this guy.
I get where Opie's coming from. I respect Opie as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I get it, but I don't agree.
But basically what happened is that they couldn't decide on who else to get. So they just said, well, we'll just co-direct. We can do it.
Yeah.
You know,
and
swing it.
And Frank went on to do other movies. You know, so he did stuff recently too. So he's still working today.
Jonathan Demme, Silence of the Lambs, which didn't we mention Jonathan Demme was
in Into the Night. Yeah. Remember I told you he directed lots of things. That's why I can't even believe you couldn't remember who it was. But yeah,
he also was slated to direct this movie. How odd. But of course there was 18 directors in Into the Night. So one of them, you know, but yeah, he was also another director that became unavailable. They agreed to do the job themselves. Its budget was $17 million, and it grossed $15.3 million.
So, yeah, that's just as bad, really.
Yeah, exactly. Like, close to breaking even, pretty bad. Roger Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars.
Yeah, he didn't love it, but he liked it.
He said, Quick Change is a funny but not inspired comedy. It has 2 directors, and I wonder if that has anything to do with its inability to be more than just efficiently entertaining.
You know, he's entitled to his opinion.
I think what you like about the movie is that it is efficiently entertaining.
Yeah, it's smooth,
right?
Like, I mean, even though it's got kind of that 2 movie quality to it. It's just a good, easy watch where everyone's enjoyable to be around.
Okay.
And, you know, there's no highs or lows. It's just good. And I think it's such a showcase for Geena Davis
right. And
Bill Murray, who I think are wonderful.
So it's like eating a chicken sandwich and not like a big, juicy hamburger.
Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. It doesn't try to be any more or less.
Right.
But it does it very well.
Okay.
You know, it's a good quality chicken sandwich.
I agree with that. I mean, 82% critics rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And 71% audience.
Yeah. And also, again, a lot of us do that. I think, again, no exaggeration, I think it's Bill Murray's best performance.
Really?
I really do.
Of all the performances, and, you know.
If I had to show someone why Bill Murray became the icon that he was.
Right.
I would show them that. They may not get it because it doesn't have the highs of Ghostbusters. Or, you know,
you don't think Ghostbusters sells Bill Murray enough?
Well, I think it does. I think he's great in it, but it doesn't show all that he can do. And I think this movie, I think this shows all that he can do.
Like you think it shows a little more range.
I think it's like a perfect sampling of what makes Bill Murray great. Yeah. Like it has the pathos of the Razor's Edge, It has the snark of Ghostbusters and Stripes. You know, it's basically Boomer used to show everything.
Well, I thought, I mean, even in the Razor's Edge, as much as I like that movie, we agree that he was a little disjointed.
Yes.
You know?
But when he's when he does try to do dramatic stuff, most of the time it works.
Yeah.
But so, and I think here in Quick Change, everything he does very well.
Yeah.
So it shows that he can do all these things.
I see.
Like, it's, to me, it's almost like, it's like a perfect encapsulation of what he's, of what his talent is.
Well, I will say, I mean, Bill Murray doesn't do like romantic comedy type movies. Yeah. I think this is probably his closest role to that, because like romantic comedy movies, you have to play like somebody who's a little bit of everything. You have to have a little wit, and you have to have a little like character development. And I think this has maybe a little bit of both. And it, it also just the complete con game that he's in, and the fact that he shows that he's, you know, a little bit vulnerable too. You know, that he doesn't, even though that he's confident, he's still admitting like, I kind of don't know what I'm doing. I'm kind of feeling this along as I go, you know?
And I mean, I don't expect everyone to agree with me. That's just my personal take on the film, is I think it's his best performance. It's not his best film.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. It's not his best movie. As long as Ghostbusters exists in the world and Lost in Translation exists in the world.
But you're just saying as an actor's performance.
It's his best performance.
I see. Okay.
Yes. And I mean, it's not the best overall film. No. I'd put it in his top 8 or maybe even top 5.
Okay.
But his best overall film? No. Not as long as Ghostbusters, Rushmore, Lost in Translation, and all those movies exist.
Yeah.
It's never going to be 1, 2, or 3, you know?
Right.
He's been in better movies,
yeah,
but he's never had, to me, a better performance than this one.
All right.
Yeah, that's just how I feel.
I'll go with that. I mean, Bill Murray's one of my favorite characters, one of my favorite actors in film. I mean, I'll watch any movie that he's in.
Yeah, he's rarely disappointing.
No. Yeah, I mean, I agree. I completely agree with that. And that's a great way to explain it. And what sort of movie recommendations then do you have?
Getting out my piece of paper to go over that.
All right.
I'm going to recommend, let's see here. I had it written down here. I don't want to fumble any details. I'm going to recommend a movie by Martin Scorsese. That's also a One Crazy Night film called After Hours.
Ah.
Okay. It stars Griffin Dunne and Rosanna Arquette and Tommy Chong.
Oh.
I'm going to read you the actual synopsis.
Okay.
An ordinary word processor has the worst night of his life after he agrees to visit a girl in Soho who he met that evening at a local coffee shop.
Mm.
And so to me, I don't want to give too much more detail about it, because part of the joy of One Crazy Night films is, again, the stuff they get up to and you don't expect, the weird twists and turns. I feel like if I go into too much detail about what actually happens, it spoils the fun of it.
Yeah.
But Scorsese, to me, has never made a bad movie. And if we're going to talk about One Crazy Night films, and we don't recommend enough Scorsese here. He's one of the best directors that ever lived.
Right.
He made a One Crazy Night film. That's what I'm going to recommend. After Hours by Martin Scorsese.
All right. That is fantastic enough. I will recommend Funny Farm. We already talked about it, but it's another movie that was, you know, that was written by the same Jay Cronley, but it also has this very sort of, even though that it's weird and it has this quirky sense, and the characters from, you know, the small town in Vermont are, you know, very sort of caricatures. It's kind of like a more sort of cartoonish look at like, what was that movie that... See, I'm bad with movie titles too. Woody Allen did, where he moves out into the woods or whatever. And
I'm not a Woody Allen fan. So I'm sorry to leave you hanging, but we went over this. I'm not a Woody Allen guy.
Anyway, the fact is, Chevy Chase. I mean, I think Chevy Chase has a lot of...
Are you thinking about Tim Allen?
No.
Okay, because Tim Allen made a similar movie like that too with Kirstie Alley.
No,
where they go out to like and live in like anyway.
Yeah. No.
We're really sputtering out here, folks.
No. All right, back to my point. My point being, Funny Farm, I mean, it has another... I mean, I think that if you look at, you know, Chevy Chase and Bill Murray have a lot in common.
Yes.
As far as, like, playing witty sort of characters and leading men. And I think that movie also kind of does the same thing, where he kind of has this wit and even though it's, you know, quirky... town or whatever that he lives in, he finally decides to kind of, you know, go with it and go with the flow. And,
yeah.
But yeah, it's really kind of a odd look at all those kind of things. But
yeah. Well, I think those are both good recommendations based on what we watched this week. I like Funny Farm. I know it's not liked by a lot of people, but I second that one. I think it's good. I think it's one of Chevy Chase's underappreciated films, and I would recommend it too.
All right. Well, thanks very much for tuning in to this week's episode of Video Culture. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Esri. Let's go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at VideoCulture2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
Make a commitment. Let's not be like every other couple on the IRT. Will you rob a bank with me?
I will, Grim. I will.
Hey! I got 3 more minutes.
We're close, Bozo.
Let's not mess with me today.
What the hell kind of clown are you?
The crying on the inside kind, I guess.
Fill this up with regular, please.
This is our perpetrator.
Average height, average build, red nose, and blue hair.
It was the perfect crime.
Guys.
Now, all they need to do is get to the airport.
Did we miss the expressway?
Getting farther away every second.
By car.
Oh, we're really making progress now.
I saw a sign, Phyllis.
Three of them out there shouting with glee.
Taxi!
By cab.
Ura Hadou. Airport. Look.
Ura Hadou.
Huh?
Great. And why don't you take us straight to Sing Sing?
There's a real cab. Stop! Taxi!
By foot. By bus.
Do you go to the airport?
Near the airport. That is an exact change.
You better get some help. You're becoming Ralph Cramden's evil twin.
By midnight. Bill Murray.
Can we just calm down a little, please?
Gina Davis.
Oh, we'll never make the flight. We'll have to sail a raft to Fiji like Thor Heyerdahl.
Please, God!
Randy Quaid.
We need a cab! One loud freaking cab!
Jason Robards.
So easy getting in. No way out.
In a major metropolitan comedy. Quick Change.
Was that our plane?
No. If it were our plane, it'd be crashing.
God, I hate this town.